When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Hey everybody, now before we get into today's interview, Field Mouse Research needs farmers to take part in paid market research. Join their Opinion Harvester panel and you will get between £10 for taking a short online survey or up to £200 for more in-depth research. The research is on a range of topics and conducted on behalf of different companies and government agencies. As we all know, it's never been more important for farmers to have their voices heard. Simply go to opinionharvester.com and fill out the short form. That's opinionharvester.com. Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming episode 177. I'm your host, Will Evans, and tonight I am tremendously excited to be heading down to Herefordshire to talk to, as your Twitter bio describes you, writer, furniture maker, enthusiast, which I really liked, Bella Bathurst. Bella, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Very, very well, thank you. Now, thank you for coming on the podcast today. Do you enjoy this aspect of writing, the promotion and talking to people about your books when they're released, or does it get a bit exhausting?
I love talking to people about the books. That's sort of the point. I mean, a book isn't really a book until it's read.
Yeah.
So it's a kind of, you know, it's always a transaction, and it's really fascinating to see what people pick up on. I mean, the stuff that they pick up on isn't necessarily the stuff that I do. So it's just really brilliant to have it sort of mirrored back to me. And I love people's responses to it and the degree to which they take it to heart or don't, you know, whatever.
Yeah. Okay. So we've got a short advert for Lima Grain to read out. Are you looking for a winter wheat with an excellent agronomic package, outstanding grain quality and end market potential? Then set your sights on LG Astronomer from Lima Grain UK. LG Astronomer scores 7.4 for Septoria, 9 for yellow and bran rust, is stiff strawed and has OWBM resistance. With a solid yield and specific weight of 77.8, LG Astronomer ticks all boxes for on-farm security and performance. It's a grade 3 wheat that's approved for distilling and biscuit making. LG Astronomer Winter Wheat, the agronomics and quality you've been looking for. Bella, we'll get on to your new book, Fieldwork, What Land Does to People and What People Do to Land, shortly. But let's start off with finding a bit about you. You were born in London, right?
I was born in London, mother Scottish from Lanarkshire, father English from Gloucester, Gloucestershire, Forest of Dean. And so I sort of grew up half and half, urban, half rural. We were up in Scotland as much as we were down in London. So it was a completely sort of, you know, it was completely sort of mixture of the two, 50-50 really.
Okay. And was there any family or friendship connections to farming at all?
Yeah, my mother has a huge extended family, or a lot of whom are still up in Lanarkshire. There's a big farm now up there run by my cousin. Okay. Dairy, they're doing gold top Jersey milk, 300 okay. Jersey cows, roboticized, really, really amazing.
Yeah.
And so there's that. I mean, basically that side of the family is sort of farming and engineering. And so, yes, I was sort of, as I sort of say at the beginning of the book, it was rural, but it wasn't farming. It was watching farming, really. There was that connection there, and but it wasn't. I mean, I would never describe myself as having sort of grown up within farming properly.
Okay, so growing up in London, what did you eventually want to do with your life? Did you always want to be a writer? Was that something you fancied doing at an early age, or did that come later?
Yes, I did. I was one of those sort of people who was very strongly sort of tilted towards essay subjects.
Okay.
They were the only ones. Basically, I was rubbish at everything else. Virtually innumerate. Still trying to count on my fingers.
Me too. I'm glad you've said that, because I am as well, which is a struggle for a farmer. Anyway.
Well, I mean, that's what calculators are for.
Exactly.
Yes. So basically was always drawn to books and writing, and just sort of headed in that direction pretty much from the start. So I guess it was a sort of easy choice to make in some ways.
And were you always good at it? I guess you must have been. Or was it something that you had to learn and develop as you got older?
You always totally have to learn. I mean, it's like that game, a minute to learn, a lifetime to master. It has no sell-by date, no retirement age, no moment at which you kind of think, okay, I've done it. I mean, I still feel intensely frustrated by my inadequacy as a writer, and I do have a very strong voice. I've always had a really strong and sort of distinctive voice. Nothing to do with me. It just sort of appeared. Yeah. And that sometimes drives me nuts, and I want to stop sounding so much like me. Basically journalism was a really good training as well. I went first into journalism. That just gives you the structure and the speed and the kind of no-nonsense sort of attitude to it, which is just the best training. And you know, how you research, all of the sort of practical nuts and bolts stuff is just, you know, comes through journalism, really.
Okay. On your writing, I mean, anyone who's read anything of yours will know that you are tremendously observant. And I even as someone who spent a lifetime in the farming community, I couldn't get over some of the things that you picked up upon in field work. I sort of found myself, that's really true. And I'd never... You know, it's just something that I don't know, just don't notice it. You know, it's so commonplace to me. But is that something that's part of who you are? I mean, are you one of those people who sort of purposely tries to stop and observe and use your senses as you go about your everyday life?
I suppose so. Although I kind of don't know any different. I mean, the only thing I suppose that makes me conscious of it was that I lost my hearing for about 12 years. So I became very conscious of hearing and other forms of communication, and of watching people and their body language, and also have been sort of drawn to, and one of the things that was absolutely lovely about talking to farmers is that by and large, they tell the truth. You're not getting kind of, I mean, apart from within the big farms, you're not getting spin. You're not getting, you don't feel like you're being kind of finessed or managed or kind of whatever. Somebody is just telling you what they think, usually in the kind of most direct way possible. It might not be necessarily something that you agree with, but it's absolutely honest, and that's just the loveliest that's just such a brilliant, refreshing thing to deal with. So, so in some ways, the sort of watching and the observation was more to do with the fact that, you know, the relationships between people on farms and the relationships between them and animals and all of that, I guess.
Okay. Your first book, The Lighthouse Stevensons, which I'm going to read after reading Fieldwork, that came out in 1999 to huge critical acclaim. Must have been an amazing feeling when you were first able to say that you were a published author. I mean, let alone when you started picking up awards. But I guess it was one of those things where you kind of, I don't know, is this really happening to me?
It was one of those things where I knew even as I was writing that I mean, although a lot of people thought it was the silliest, I mean, just the daftest idea to write about kind of lighthouses, and that I got lucky. I can recognize a good story. Mm-hmm. It might not be a new story in the sort of in the journalistic sense, but I knew that was an extraordinary story, and that I'd arrived at a sort of particularly critical moment, just as they were automating the last of the Scottish lighthouses. And these lighthouses are just extraordinary. I mean, how the hell they built those things at the end of the 17th, beginning of the 18th century. I mean, it was just, they are so beautiful, yeah. and so phenomenal. And they were such an extraordinary family. It became a sort of collective biography. And I just loved it. So in a sense, yeah, the acclaim was kind of, oh God, this is scary. This is weird.
I'll bet.
But on the other hand, in a sense, it wasn't to do with me, because all I had to do, I recognised when I was writing it, is tell it straight and not fuck it up.
that's good advice for any aspiring writers, I guess. Since then, you've written several books with very varying subject matters. So what first led you to write a book about farmers?
I think it was, I'd been getting sort of increasingly interested with farming and that relationship between people and land, and that thing, you know, in the subtitle about what land does to people and people do to land. And when I moved to Rye's Farm, which I write about in the book, whatever it was, nearly 8 years ago, it became more and more vivid. This is a profession unlike any other. It's so singular. Everything is so completely sort of bound up. You know, family history, identity. Mm-hmm. Land, business, money, you know, I mean, just huge, huge stuff, you know, in a way that you just don't get in estate agency. and there's also that sort of multi-generational thing that you know, problems or issues that have, you know, they could have developed literally half a century ago,
yeah,
and they're still resonating now. And just looking at the farms around me and just thinking, everybody is ranting on and on about kind of, you know, farming. We should be doing this, we should be doing that, you know, we should be doing it differently. Farmers are, you know, such bad people, they're kind of hosing the whole place with chemicals, you know, it's too intense, you know, whatever it happens to be. Mm-hmm. But nobody's actually looking at the people, and they're far more interesting than you know, another kind of, if you don't start with the people, there's no point in having a rant about kind of how we should be sort of rewilding or reintroducing snipe or whatever.
I totally agree, and I suppose that's why I started this podcast 4 years ago, I guess, was to try and speak to farmers so people could hear their voices. You've said that you were struck by the mismatch between the public version of farming and the apparent truth of it, and there seemed to be so many contradictions. What were your ideas about farmers? I mean, I guess having farmers in your family as perhaps different as someone who has no connection to farming at all. But what were your ideas about farmers before you moved to Rice Farm?
I think, as you say, it wasn't that I got it kind of wildly wrong. It wasn't like I didn't know where sausages came from. And it was more that almost sort of biblical sense of sort of the degree to which, situations could develop over years and years and years, and a farm almost by definition is sort of at the end of the road, is at the end of the road, on these on patches of land, which sometimes nobody ever goes to. That's the very sort of traditional old school upland hill farm image, which by and large is the image of farming that the urban public have. Mm-hmm. And I think it was sort of seeing this kind of the dwindling of the workforce, the fact that the jobs that would have been done by not half the village but a chunk of the village now are now being done by one 80-year-old bloke with a gammy leg kind of thing, and just the huge pressure and just that thing of gambling, the endless gambling of farming that, last week the lamb price dropped by 20 quid or kind of whatever it was. Mm-hmm. The kind of thing, there's no other profession where that happens on a monthly basis kind of thing. The prices just go like that.
Yeah.
And why is that not extraordinary? Why are we not talking about that?
Yeah,
you say with your podcast, and looking at the range of characters that you've interviewed over that 4 years, the range of people within farming is just extraordinary, and they're captured as sort of there's about two different archetypes, it's either kind of cold comfort farm and some kind of straw chewing yokel.
Yes.
Or it's somebody who's kind of sort of East Anglian sort of grain baron kind of thing, and the podcast, there isn't a single none of the people in all the 4 years that you've interviewed, I assume, fall into either of those categories. It's just the richness and the diversity and the splendor of what people are doing out there, unseen and unheard quite a lot of the time, is just amazing.
I think a lot of us in farming think that we're often seen as this kind of homogenous mass, farmers, and yet when you start drilling down into farming, it's so interesting. As you said, every farm's different. In this, where I live, mostly mixed or livestock farms, and yet every farm and every family situation is different. Everybody's farming in a different way, and that's even before you get into other sectors and other areas of the country. So I'm glad you said that. Although you speak to many people in the book, I guess that Bert is the main character in a way, and I certainly recognise several aspects of his character in farmers I know, especially here in the Welsh Borders. Tell us about him.
He was my landlord when I first moved to Rice Farm, and he was a lovely, complicated, difficult, funny, stubborn man, and he and I got on really well, and I really enjoyed talking to him. He had a very funny and distinctive way of kind of looking at the world. Mm-hmm. And he also had this huge bank of knowledge that he didn't rate, and the world didn't rate, and a way of looking at the landscape, and that thing of that I kind of try and describe in the book of of looking at it, looking at things vertically. So he would look at a piece of land and see it down the generations and down through the soil. And, you know, he could give me, you know, he could have written books on one field, basically. Mm-hmm. And so I learned a huge amount just by listening to him. He died very sadly while I was living on the farm. Mm-hmm. And his son, with whom he'd always had a pretty vexed relationship, has now taken over and is taking the farm in a different direction, or just moving it along to the next phase. So I wanted to write about him and Rye's farm and what Bert and the Berts of this world kind of represent.
Yeah.
But also, and why there's something, you know, why I don't know. Anyway, yeah, so basically he was the link in the book.
For sure.
So he is there all the way through, as is Rye's farm and all the other characters involved with it.
Yeah. You mentioned the often difficult relationship he had with his son. And I think that's a story that's all too common in farming. And I guess we all have our own theories why it's often like that. But I was really struck by, again, some of your observations. Why do you think it is so difficult in farming for older farmers sometimes to pass on to, or I should say, to let things go perhaps to the next generation?
I think, I mean, all sorts of different reasons, but partly because it's not a job. You are a farmer.
Mm.
It's not you don't do farming, you are farming. And therefore, and also because it's absolutely built around that you know, sort of life goes on, you just keep going, whatever happens, snow, floods, droughts, you know, bereavement, epidemics, you know, pandemics, kind of whatever it is, you just keep going. And so, you know, someone in their 80s, in whom that ethic of just kind of keeping going, it's not going to be able to, they're going to keep on keeping going, because they see it as, or can see it as, sort of, if they don't keep going, then they're being kind of stripped of their identity. And again, there's the issue with, sort of, you know, older farmers moving out of the main farmhouse and making way for the next generation, who may have been kind of stuffed into a bungalow with six of them, kind of all bursting at the seams, and that endless pressure to, sort of, from the younger generation, that they want to get on, they want to innovate, they want to take the farm in a new direction, and it's the old bull and the young bull, basically.
Yeah.
And it just plays itself out in various different sort of, you know, iterations endlessly, because you get, you know, it's either father son, or it's father daughter, or it's mother son, or it's mother and daughter and daughter. I mean, there's just so many, or two siblings, or kind of whatever it is. But you know, everything bleeds into everything, so it's not like you can kind of treat it like an office job and kind of go, okay, well, these are the dividing lines. You go home at six, and that you close the computer and you're off. It just doesn't work like that.
No, you're never off the job, are you? Yeah, no, I think you're right with that. It's something I think about a lot, and I'm sort of quite fortunate with my father. We have a very good relationship, but having said that, it's not always been easy. And, you know, I think my dad loves this farm in such a way that it's almost quite a possessive love. And I think a lot of farmers are like that. And I think that's perhaps why it's so difficult sometimes to let go even a little bit, because they've worked so hard to make it what it is, that it's quite hard to just let go of that bit of control. But yeah.
That possessiveness, that was what I was sort of struggling to nail down on the page. But that possessiveness is a really, really interesting thing, because it's love, basically. Yes,
it is, yeah.
But it's something. If your father was here and trying to sum it up, what would he say? How would he say how he felt about the farm?
Yeah, he's probably still dealing with the relationship he had with his own father, isn't he? And I guess that's something that comes across in the book. You know, we're all, as it goes on, I suppose we're all still dealing with that and trying to navigate that situation, aren't we? That family situation, that dynamic that makes it so unique, I suppose.
I think farmers do definitely practice this sort of bizarre, esoteric form of ancestor worship.
For sure. I totally agree. And yeah, there's a chapter on succession in the book talking about sons and fathers or daughters, and you talk about a meeting you attended with several farming families talking about the subject with former rock and roll farming guest, the wonderful Heather Wildman. And I found this chapter particularly moving because it is just so difficult for many of us, and you could really sort of feel that difficulty where people wanted to, I thought you expressed this really well, where people, you could see that they wanted to talk but they didn't quite know how to express it, as they did begin to talk about it, I think they probably did realize they weren't the only ones struggling with it, and the farmers there did start to visibly make progress with it. Is that what you saw as well?
Very definitely. I think there was a sort of real electricity, there was a real charge in the room, and I think it was an extraordinary thing for Heather to have been able to facilitate and make possible those conversations and the beginnings of something. I don't know what those conversations turned into, and I don't know whether anything came of those, but my feeling was that they did. And you know, the subjects are so difficult. There was just this sense of rust in the room, you know, that everybody had not talked about stuff for so long that they'd kind of rusted over.
Yeah.
And again, I mean, that's not entirely fair, because there were some families who had a very sort of healthy level of communication and sort of regular updates and that sort of thing. But even the younger generation have great, you know, they do have difficulties just because the stakes are so high. You're talking about kind of, you know, how things move on and how you split the farm between four siblings or kind of whatever it happens to be. So I just find it sort of, I find it really moving and really, really extraordinary and very powerful. One of the things that I find really, there were two things that I find really, really revealing. One was that everybody sort of did a kind of, Heather set the whole thing up with a sort of role play at the end. So there was a kind of scenario that she gave each different table and or group, and everybody had to sort of role play a different sort of thing. And it was kind of, you know, let's say a small declining farm in debt, bank knocking on the door, and somebody wanting, you know, the possibility of planning permission also, and two farm siblings, one off farm sibling who wanted their money out, kind of thing, or whatever it was, and everybody kind of role played sort of differently, and that was really powerful. But not one single person around that table even suggested the idea of selling the farm or the land. I mean, there is an absolute inertia on it's just never going to happen. It's just like kind of, you would no more, you know, sell the land than I don't know why. It's just, yeah. And to me, the kind of thing of, well, could you at least have a conversation about kind of selling the farm? It was the elephant in the room. Didn't even come up.
No.
And the other thing was just the thing that I write about in the book, which was just that thing of kind of, you know, collectively by getting these people in a room, you got this kind of sense of every single one of them talked about the farm as a thing bigger than any of them. It had its own momentum. It had its own energy.
Yeah.
And sometimes they just felt like kind of these little individuals just being fed endlessly into the mouth of this everlastingly sort of hungry thing called the farm.
Yes. Well, yeah. And I said to you that when I was reading it, I had to put the book down several times because it did make me quite emotional at parts. And this was one of the things on that subject that did have that effect where I had to sort of put it down and take a deep breath. And as this is a quote from the book, over and over, every one of the families talks about the farm as a fourth presence, a character in its own right, a personality larger and more dominant than any single individual. Their farm has its own needs and drives, its own determination, its own ecosystem of luck, faith, and judgment. It doesn't matter if their owners or tenants, what acreage they have, or what type. Every person here treats the farm and the land as a living thing. I'm struggling to think of anything that I've ever read that sums up what my farm is to me better than this. It is a living thing and it is ever present. And it was quite refreshing. I found it quite refreshing. Perhaps I haven't read it phrased like that before. But you wrote about the joy of farming, the joy that it can bring, and it can be joyous at times, but also what a terrible burden it can be as well. And you know, farming does have a very well documented problem with mental health. It seemed that many of the people you spoke to for the book talked about that. Is that something that you were expecting beforehand? Did that take you by surprise?
What, the mental health aspect, or the degree to which it the farm is a living thing?
Both, I think. The burden, I suppose, the burden of expectation that the farm, that people feel.
I think,
that the,
I tried not to emphasize. I didn't want to rewrite Cold Comfort Farm. Although actually, I did read Cold Comfort Farm halfway through writing it, and kind of thought, you know, because Cold Comfort Farm is kind of, you know, it's one of the you know, it was written kind of donkeys years ago in the 1950s, I think so. And it's, you know, something in the woodshed and Aunt Ada Doom, the Starcatters, and that sort of thing. And I reread it when I was writing this, and just kind of thought, this is a searing work of social documentary.
Yeah.
I mean, this is just kind of like kind of this is just telling it like it is, basically. And you kind of think that's that thing of kind of, you know, everybody's kind of locked into a set of roles that they don't necessarily want, but have just been established over for so long.
Yeah.
And that everybody is looking back to what grandfather or great grandfather or great 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 grandfather sometimes did. Can sometimes be really pronounced. And that thing of that thing that comes up very strongly, obviously, in the succession meetings, which is, okay, let's say you've got three siblings. The parents bend over backwards to try and split the farm in such a way that all three children benefit equally. But you can't do that with a farm. The farm has to go to somebody.
Yeah.
And sometimes the person that it goes to is inheriting something that is as much of a burden as a privilege. So while the other two siblings, the off-farm siblings, might apparently be jealous, actually have they got away scot-free? Because they're not taking, they don't have to deal with the ancestors. They don't have to deal with the kind of expectations for the next generation. They don't have to deal with, you know, everybody looking over the hedge. They can sort of theoretically take the money, and or they may passionately want the farm themselves, or all three siblings may be totally uninterested, in which case they have to, you know, it's just so. Yeah, that thing of sort of succession and that sort of dynastic weight,
yeah,
is really strong.
Yeah.
I think land itself has a charge. You know, some land is generous and some land just isn't.
Mm. Yeah, no, I definitely agree. Another thing that I found very moving was the way that you wrote about bovine TB. And I live in an area that's very badly affected and very close friends and neighbours who are having a hellish time with it at the moment. You know, you really haven't shied away from the big issues in this book. Was it hard to talk to farmers about things like this? Because they did seem to really open up to you about what are incredibly difficult subjects to deal with.
I think as long as people realise or kind of know, basically, you're not from the ministry, you're not asking them for money.
Yeah.
And you're not telling them that they're doing something wrong or just about to fine them for something. And hopefully that you're not a total sort of idiot, and possibly that you come with a bit of an intro, you know, that you are, you know, a tenant on the farm or kind of whatever it is, then they will talk to you. So there's a sort of chain of connections, and those connections kind of, you know, one door opens from. I think that the TB and the foot and mouth, I mean, there was just foot and mouth in particular just left. It felt as if it was a sort of ground zero and that it left a long, deep, unspoken scar, a really deep scar. And that part of the difficulty with bovine TB is that it reopens that scar every time.
Yeah.
I mean, bovine TB is different because it's extended over time, but that endless thing of sort of retesting and reactors and locking down and that sort of thing, it's mentally and emotionally, I mean, it's so, so punishing. And for anybody who went through foot and mouth, I just think, I mean, how the hell people stand it, I don't know. I mean, you could probably say much more about kind of your experience around if it really, you know, if there's a cluster of it in Wrexham or round Wrexham, then just, you know,
I was speaking to a good friend of mine the other day, and obviously none of us have seen that many people lately, but I went to bale some hay for a very good friend of mine who's one of the best farmers I know, dairy farmer, small farm, family farm, all permanent pasture, milking sort of about 100-120 cows. The kind of farm that you go on the yard and everything's immaculate. They love it and the land and everything. And this is a guy I was in school with, same age as me. And I said, how are you? You know, I got there and we had a bit of chat, a bit of catching up. I said, how are you doing? How's the TB situation? Because that's what we all ask. You know, it's always one of the first questions you ask. And he said, I've just had enough. He said, I can't, I think they've lost sort of 40, you know, they're only milking 70 cows now because they've lost so many over the last 6 months. And he said, I just can't keep doing this. And we had that conversation that, you know, both of us left school when we were 16 and went home to the farm and assumed we would farm our entire lives, and we've never done anything else. And he said, I don't know what else to do. He said, because if we sell the cows, this is a dairy farm. You know, it's not like they can plow it up and grow out in a small fields or permanent pastures. I've no idea what else I want to do. And it was so, I just felt so sad for him and his family, but also sad because I think those are the kind of farms that people want, really, those small family farms who really care about every square inch of land and where the flowers grow in the spring and, you know, the kind of history and tradition of it. And those, you know, it's not an intensive farm, not a super farm. Those are the farms I think people want, but they're going because of these issues. And I find that intensely sad, also intensely frustrating that we can't get that through. That's just one story. I mean, there's so many, you know, I've talked to people on the podcast about it. It's a struggle. I don't know what to do. You know, it's just incredibly difficult, I think, for the farming community.
With talking about the big issues, you can't avoid them.
No.
Those issues are so, so huge and so in your face, and that sense of absolute, you know, having your heart sort of pulled out very, very slowly,
yeah,
and stamped on. And is really acute, it's really apparent sometimes, and you know, and sometimes it's bovine TB and sometimes it's just a milk price.
Yeah.
It's the fact that you know, this absolute sort of impossibility of profitability. Mm. and the contempt, and also that thing of sort of contempt, the contempt in which, you know, sort of shown by a low price, if you see what I mean, and for the work that's actually taken to produce, kind of thing. Mm. And that would, I mean, I couldn't farm. I really couldn't farm. It would break my heart. And I think anybody who does and can withstand that thing, that the threat of TB or just a kind of, you know, the unpredictability of prices, or kind of, you know, global thing, or welfare, mm. kind of, you know, all of those, or shooting bull cubs or whatever. I mean, it's really, really tough at the moment. Really tough.
Mm.
And what do you think your friend's going to do? Do you think he will get out?
I don't know. He doesn't know. I mean, they're talking about it. He said to me that, you know, if they have another major breakdown, that they'll sell the cows, but he's not really sure what they'll do with the farm. I mean, they've been, you know, they own the farm, they've been there for quite a while, and I don't know, you know, whether he'll look to rear heifers for a neighbouring dairy farm. You know, there's a lot of big dairy farms around the area now, you know, whether he'll look to do something like that, but I think there's not a massive amount of options. You know, I guess he could rent it out and go and milk cows for someone else or something like that, but, you know, he doesn't want to do that.
The one good thing, which is a point made by one of the really big farmers in the book, is that farmers themselves don't rate their skills, but mm. farmers are the multi-tools of the workforce. I mean, they because you have to be so adaptable, because you have to be a vet, an accountant, an economist, a politician, a diplomat, an agronomist, a bureaucrat, or, you know, all these different things, just kind of within an hour, practically. Mm. That adaptability and that sort of, okay, it's not like you encounter a problem and you kind of walk away and it'll sort of, you know, somebody else will sort it out. It's that sort of, okay, there's a problem, how do we solve that?
Mm.
Which is the most sought after and brilliant thing in the workplace, and farmers kind of think of themselves as kind of, you know, they can only do what they can do.
Yeah.
But actually, those skills are just about the most desirable and you know, qualities to have.
Mm.
End of story. It doesn't matter whether it's in the workplace or just generally, I think.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Despite many of the hardships and the difficulties you write about, and we've obviously just been talking about that, there is also an underlying humour in the book too, which I enjoyed. And one of my favourite things about farming is, despite everything, despite weather pressures and global commodity prices and new agricultural policies, when we get together, usually, whether it be in the pub or livestock market or social occasion, usually we'll be laughing about something, even if it's gallows humour. Is that what you found too?
Oh, totally, yes. And I would hate in any way to depict it as a gloomy thing. It's incredibly funny. One of the reasons that I wanted to write about Bert was because he had such a brilliant turn of phrase.
Yeah.
And I mean, I so liked his description of his mentor. He said he wasn't a bad driver. It was just that you didn't always know which side of the road he was going to pass you on.
Yeah,
and also a friend of mine's description of sheep. You know, if they could, they'd die twice.
Yeah.
And just kind of, you know, there was sort of small things like that. But yes, absolutely. And also just, I mean, both the humour and also just the joy in it as well. The you know, you get a good day, or yeah, you get a good price, or you get a kind of, you know, whatever it happens to be. But it's just that thing of every day you get to feel like you've actually really done something in a really, really straightforward way. You planted out that field, you stop the gap in the fence, you kind of, you know, you just move things on.
Yeah.
In a way, there's something so lovely and so straightforward and so honestly knackering about it that is really, really lovely. So yes, I mean, yeah. Yes. Having spent a lot of time and spent most of my 20s in Lanarkshire and around Glasgow, I have a high bar for humour. But
yes, I'm sure.
But yes, absolutely. Farmers are very funny.
Yeah. It's interesting you say that, actually, because sometimes about the job, sometimes I guess we're all guilty of forgetting that sometimes, but I mean, I now sort of through this podcast now that sort of got into a few other industry things, and I sometimes have to spend a day or two in front of a computer on Zoom meetings or emails and phone calls, and I'm often, which I enjoy and I love doing, but often I cannot wait to just go and do a bit of fencing or a bit of move some cattle or just do one of those jobs where I can switch my phone off and do that. And I think perhaps sometimes we don't realize how lucky we are that we've got that, because you know, a lot of people in other jobs never get to do that. So yeah, the book does end with a message of hope. I think I really like the ending, and I'm just gonna, do you want to quote you again if that's okay? Once every few years there's a heat wave. And by the way, I should say this, I'm a huge history geek. I'm really interested in the sort of history of farms and land and people, how they got to their farms anyway. So this really appealed to me. So once every few years, there's a heat wave and the outlines of the land come up altered, as if the color of centuries had all been drained off for a moment. Circles and squares rise up, lines resurge. Phantom mansions, long gone airfields and spectral forts lift themselves from the parched barley. And with them comes the recognition that this land has been recycled 1,000 times already, far before the Romans and long after all trace of us. Firstly, that's a wonderful piece of writing. And again, that was something that kind of made me have to take a breath. But secondly, I take great comfort in that I'm part of something, a long tradition of people making a living on this land. And we've found, you know, I've had a friend of mine with a metal detector's found Roman coins and things here. You know, I know this farm's been farmed for well over 2,000 years. But the reason why I found that comfortable was, you know, there's always been changes and whatever comes our way, and there are going to be some big changes, I think, over in the immediate future, we will adapt and survive. And that's how the book left me feeling. So in my very long and rambly way, I suppose what I'm trying to say is thank you for putting it like that, because that left me feeling quite comforted and positive for the future.
Oh, good. Yeah. Well, which, I mean, rightly so. And I don't. I mean, there's a lot of people who kind of think that the future is only intensification and because of the you know, sliver thin margins, you've got to be big, you've got to amalgamate,
yeah.
You've got to kind of increase the size of every field and that sort of thing. My sense is that there will always be a space for small farms, and because they've existed for 7,000 years, and they are uniquely adapted to the land. They work with the land, and that relationship between a person or a family and a patch of land is such a deep one. I was really struck by the fact that when I went to Harper Adams and talked to a bunch of the students, equally split between male and female, and only one was going to inherit. The rest were a lot of them were kind of new entrants, and they were kind of impatient and frustrated with the kind of old system and desperately wanted to get into it. But I asked them right at the end, okay, money no object, what's your dream? Every single one of them separately said a version of, I just want a few acres and a herd of cows or a flock of sheep or kind of whatever it was. So that it's almost like a small holding dream. That thing of kind of small patch of land that you can know as well as you know your own children is you will never take that away from people. That will never go because I'm totally hopeful about the future, because I think some that's sort of actually oddly enough where we're heading.
You've had a brilliant reaction to the book. I know you're on Fieldwork, the book club, last week. I didn't tune in because I didn't want to be, I will watch it back, but I thought if I watch that, then I'll end up asking the same question. So I deliberately stayed away this week, but I know that people have loved the book. Are you planning on writing anything else about farming, or are you already sort of thinking about something different now?
I would really like to. I think that thing of writing about land, I've got two books that I'm working on at the moment. One of it, which is an old project to do with photography and stuff, which I've been working on for ages and keep putting down and picking up.
Yeah.
So there's that. But there's also another one. So Lanarkshire, where I'm sort of from, is a very heavily mined and farmed area. And I'm researching something to do with that. So it's absolutely to do with the land, but it's to do with sort of, you know, something to do with all those histories that you were talking about, what comes up from underneath and you know, the legacy of all that. And then in terms of sort of another book about farming, I think because I've just built my own house, I'm sort of thinking about kind of possibly writing about construction, but I can't work out kind of quite how. So that'll happen at some point, I think.
Just before we start to wrap up, as I mentioned in the intro, you're a furniture maker as well, which I'm always hugely impressed by, and listeners can see examples of your work on your website. How did you start with that?
I've always been kind of completely sort of fascinated by wood, by trees and by wood. About 7-8 years ago, I went and did a furniture making course down at the Boat Building Academy in Lyme Regis. it was the first experience I'd had of being well taught at anything, because it was just a total joy. Absolutely loved it. It was, again, it was sort of a bit like farming. It was sort of come back at the end of every day, dog tired. I mean, having worked at 12, 14, kind of whatever the hours a day, and then I was trying to fit in writing at the same time. But I spent most of my time either laughing or in tears, because it was just that thing of kind of the learning curve was so steep that it was kind of, you know, in some ways sort of, it was just a blimey. It was like accelerating up a hill. And have been making furniture ever since, basically. So I write in the mornings and make furniture in the afternoons, or, you know, that's roughly how it goes, basically.
Amazing. Yeah, I mean, it must be some of the most tremendously satisfying work than you could do, I'd imagine. What's the best wood to work with, and what's your favourite thing to make?
I think if I had a choice, I mean, walnut is just... anything you make out of walnut, yes. it just looks classy. It's such lovely wood. You can do anything to it and it comes up looking gorgeous. And oak, inevitably, because it carries so much history and so many stories. So the farm that I was on, Rise Farm, I've taken a lot of the joists, which the old farm joists are 300 years old, and they're full of nails and that sort of thing. And I'm making sort of tables out of these things, which are just covered in all the sort of history of the, and they're stained dark brown by the horse's pee, because the horse was going around the mill wheel, and that's just brilliant. And oak carries all of that, all the kind of colors through the tannin, and yeah, anyway, so I do that, and forgot the rest of it. Sorry.
what's your favorite thing to make? Is it tables
or? I think because again, that's really straightforward in that, you know, at the end of the day, you've either got a table that you can eat your dinner off, or you don't, you've just got a pile of wood shavings. Yeah. And, you know, compared to writing, which is quite sort of nebulous, I mean, it's quite sort of, well, you've got a pile of words, but you might well delete half of them tomorrow.
Sure.
That thing of kind of, it's a table. Does it stand up? Brilliant. If it doesn't, then you've got a problem. And it's just kind of, yeah, it's that thing of making a difference at the end of every day, isn't it?
Of course. Have you made your own writing desk? Do you write on something you've made?
I haven't, because I got a beautiful one that I bought about 20 years ago up in Edinburgh for about £300, and don't need to. And also it's that thing of kind of you go to most furniture makers' houses and, you know, everything in it is from IKEA, because they just don't have time to make stuff, and they've got to prioritise, you know, the stuff that they're selling as well.
Fantastic. Okay. Let's move on to the traditional hard-hitting questions to finish. And just sort of going back to the reasons why I started this podcast, and perhaps the reasons why you write the book, before we do these questions, there is a point to these silly questions in that I wanted to sort of say, yes, farmers do have a favourite song, and yes, we do. We're no different than anyone else. So although sometimes these questions may appear a bit silly at the end, there is a point to them. Anyway. What is your all-time favourite song?
I had to really think about this one. Pulp, Something Changed.
Oh, man, that's such a good choice. I love Pulp. That's a brilliant choice. I like that a lot. Very classy. What book have you read and reread more than any other?
Watership Down. I think it's probably a bit of a cliche, but I mean, I read that book first when I was about 9. And I've just reread it and reread it and reread it. And you know, I learned all sorts of small things out of that, like wildflower names and that sort of.
Yeah, beautiful. If you could time travel for a day, where and when would you go?
Genuinely don't know. I don't know whether I'd go forwards or backwards. I think probably forwards. I don't know. I think in order to time travel, Am I allowed a sex change as well? Because,
because
I think if I went backwards, I think the options for women were so limited, and I wouldn't be able to do any of the things that I am now able to do as a woman pretty much any other time than now. Yeah. So if I was allowed to go backwards, then it would be as a man if I was allowed to go forward, then can I stay as a woman, please?
Yes, you can. All right. What's your idea of a perfect Sunday?
At the moment, I think it would be going to see some live music with
Fred. Nice.
I would so love to do that. I would just really, really love to do that. I think that thing of just being surrounded by sound, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's choral music or kind of electronic or dance or, you know, whatever it is, or that sort of festival stuff or whatever, just that. In that thump inside your bones, kind of. I need a bit of that.
Definitely, yeah, I totally agree. And lastly, then, a traditional way to end. I don't know if you do much on social media or not, but I do always end with this question: what's your favourite farming-related social media account to follow, and why?
I think probably it would be the Fieldwork Book Club. I mean, they only started in January, and Adam Bedford has created something really phenomenal.
Such a great guy as well, Adam. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. He comes across as such a lovely man.
He is,
and such a and such as a champion for farmers and farming. And I mean, I'm biased because they've just done field work, but I just think that he's doing something really, a bit like you, that is a genuine sort of force for good, and that's really, really powerful.
Yeah, they had the Irish poet Jane Clark on one of them a few months ago, and that was fab. I found that really good, and I've since sort of gone out and bought a couple of her books, and I found her poetry so moving, talking about farmers and talking about farmers' relationships between fathers and sons, which is something she writes about quite a lot. Anyway, Bella, thank you so much for your time, and a truly heartfelt thank you for writing this book. It really is one of the best things I've read on farming and the people in our community. I think you've really done us proud. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much, and it's been wonderful, and I'm just really grateful that you think that I've got anywhere close to being right about any of it.
And I do urge anyone listening to check the book out. To everyone out there, thanks for listening, and hope to see you next time. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.